Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
This is an RNZ podcast.
In the last episode, we talked about the driving force behind the wars in Waikato, Taranaki and Tauranga. Overwhelming demand from settlers for Māori land.
This demand didn't just come from ordinary colonists. There was also a group of extremely rich and powerful investors who made piles of money buying and selling that land. People like Frederick Whittaker and Thomas Russell. Russell was the founder of BNZ Bank. Some of these investors were also senior figures in the colonial government. During the Waikato War, Frederick Whittaker was the Premier and Thomas Russell was the Minister for Defence. Both these men pushed for war and for the confiscation of Māori land, then made huge profits buying and selling that land.
In the meantime, land confiscations and the disruption of the war caused huge frustration and fear for many North Island Māori. This flowed into support for religious movements, which seemed to offer Māori a way out of the conflict.
Those movements started peacefully, but in the end, the fighting only got more brutal.
I'm Lee Marama McLaughlin.
I'm William Ray, and this is the Aotearoa History Show.
We arrange ourselves without fear, beside Britain. Where she goes, we go. Where she stands, we stand.
The New Zealander, Hillary, has succeeded in conquering Mount Everest.
New Zealand wins from Mount Everest.
A real shambles here at Rugby Park Hamilton. Red smoke bombs being thrown by the demonstrators.
We are marching to Parliament. And no more land to be sold.
The end of the war in Waikato coincided with the rise of a Māori prophet, a man called Te Ua Haumeni. Te Ua had been an early convert to Christianity back in the 1830s, but his experience fighting Pākehā and Taranaki and tensions over land made him question the teachings of European missionaries. In 1862, Te Ua said he had visions of an angel who told him that Māori were God's new chosen people. He preached that God would deliver land taken by Pākehā back into Māori hands. He called his new religion Pai Mārire.
In some ways, you could see Pai Mārire as a form of kotahitanga, a Māori unity movement. It's sort of similar to kingitanga. Both movements were trying to forge bonds between Māori of different iwi to resist Pākehā pressure for land. Te Ua called for peaceful resistance. In fact, Pai Mārire literally translates to good and peaceful. But the pressure for land kept growing. The government sent in so-called military settlers to occupy confiscated land. Basically, these were British soldiers who were told that so long as they could keep Māori off the land, it would be theirs to keep. The situation was incredibly tense.
In 1864, a group of Pai Mārire warriors ambushed a British army patrol in Taranaki. They killed 7 troops before the rest of the patrol escaped. Then they cut the heads off the corpses and gave them to Te Ua Haumeni. This was an old tradition in Māori warfare. Claiming an enemy's head was a way to degrade their mana and enhance your own. But the British were horrified by the beheadings. Governor Grey described Pai Marire as, quote, repugnant to all humanity, and he outlawed the religion.
General Duncan Cameron tried to suppress the faith by force, but that didn't stop its spread. Frustrations with dodgy land sales and confiscation made many Māori sympathise with Pai Marire. In the Bay of Plenty, Te Ua's disciples rallied support from Te Whakatohia, one of the major iwi in the region.
Te Whakatohia had not taken part in the New Zealand Wars, but they were frustrated that the murder of one of their rangatira by a pro-government iwi had gone unpunished by Governor Grey. Plus, some people believed the government was spying on them through a local missionary called Carl Volkner.
A faction of Te Whakatohia took action. They ritually executed Volkner. Then one of Te Ua's followers desecrated his corpse. In their eyes, this was justified as utu, both for Volkner spying and the death of their rangatira.
But Pākehā colonists saw all this very differently. For them, it was confirmation that Pai Marire were violent anti-European fanatics. These colonists wanted retaliation for what they saw as a brutal murder, and they also wanted the government to step up its efforts to suppress Pai Marire.
This is partly what triggered the next major offensive of the New Zealand Wars. A four-week campaign into central Taranaki, led by General Trevor Shute. When you read about this campaign, you'll see phrases like scorched earth tactics and take no prisoners. An official back in London wrote this about Shute's campaign.
I doubt whether the natives have ever attempted to devastate our settlements as we are devastating theirs. There is more destruction than fighting.
Okay, so some people were uneasy about this campaign, but it was very popular with the vast majority of colonial settlers. From the mid-1860s onwards, more and more colonists directly participated in the fighting as volunteer militia. These militia often lacked the discipline of professional British soldiers. Like in Taranaki, a group called the Kai Iwi Cavalry ignored the orders of their officers and charged a group of young, unarmed Māori boys, killing two of them.
But it wasn't just Europeans fighting Pai Marire. In fact, the majority of the fighting in this phase of the New Zealand Wars was Māori fighting other Māori. Partly this was to do with intertribal tensions, which predated European arrival in New Zealand. But also, many Māori felt the new faith undermined the mana of rangatira by encouraging people to pledge their allegiance to a prophet. On the east coast, you saw many members of Rongowa Kata and Te Aitanga a Mahaki become followers of Pai Marire. They then got into some very serious conflicts with Ngāti Porou and Ngāti Kahungunu, both of whom were mostly allied with the government.
This all ended with some bloody battles around 1865, where Pai Marire forces were largely defeated. 300 or 400 Pai Marire supporters were exiled from the east coast to Whare Kauri, the Chatham Islands.
This is where we meet the next major religious leader of the New Zealand Wars. Among the exiles was a Rongowa Kata man called Te Koti Arikirangi Te Turuki. The government had accused Te Koti of spying for Pai Marire, but without evidence. He definitely wasn't a follower of Pai Marire, he'd actually fought against them. But he was sent off to live in exile without any trial. And while he was gone, the government confiscated his land.
While he was in the Chatham Islands, Te Koti got sick. Tossing and turning in his cot, he had religious visions and believed he'd heard the voice of God. He founded a new religion called Ringatu, the upraised hand, and it rapidly gained support among the exiles. In 1868, Te Koti and his followers captured a supply ship, sailed back to the mainland, and began a guerrilla campaign which roamed all the way from the east coast over to the shores of Lake Taupō and up through the dense forests of Uruwera.
''1868 was a very scary year for the colonial government. At the same time as they were fighting Te Kōti on the east coast, they were also fighting another Māori prophet in Taranaki. The Ngāti Rua Nui Rangatira, Rifa Te Tokowaru. Te Tokowaru took over the leadership of Pai Marire after Te Ua Haumine died in 1866. He tried to end the fighting in Taranaki by preaching pacifism to his followers and meeting with British garrisons. But as the government continued to confiscate and settle Taranaki land, he was backed into a corner, facing the colonial army and its Māori allies with, at first, only a handful of warriors.
Unfortunately for the government, Te Tokowaru turned out to be a military genius. He made extensive use of the same kind of fortified anti-artillery power which had worked so well against the British in earlier wars. British troops took huge casualties trying to breach these defences, and then Māori would just withdraw deeper into the bush and set up another par.
But by the late 1860s, British military leaders had worked out this tactic, so they were reluctant to fight head-on. Te Tokowaru had to find another way to keep the British coming out to fight on his terms. And he did this with a series of letters he sent to the British authorities. Here's one of the more famous ones.
I have begun to eat the flesh of the white man. I have eaten him like the flesh of the cow, cooked in the pot. All have eaten him, even the women and the children. My throat is continually open for the eating of human flesh by day and by night.
This was a bluff. Te Tokowaru never actually ate anybody. Historians like James Bellich think Te Tokowaru was using threats like this to outrage and provoke the Crown forces so they would keep throwing themselves at his specially prepared defences. And it worked. At the Battle of Te Nutu o Te Manu, the Crown forces were dealt a crushing defeat when they came under heavy fire from warriors who were hidden in hollow trees and under other kinds of camouflage. One of the people killed was the famous Prussian mercenary Gustavus von Tempsky, who Māori called Manuro, 100 birds. His death was seen as a tragedy for Pākehā settlers and a huge victory for Taranaki Māori.
By this point, the New Zealand wars had dragged on for more than 20 years and the government was freaking out. Some people worried that if Te Tokowaru, Te Kōti and Kingitanga all unified, they might be a serious threat to the whole colony. Colonists in Whanganui were fleeing their homes. Some left New Zealand altogether.
Writers in Pākehā newspapers started to suggest the only long-term solution was the total extermination of Māori, which ignored the fact that many of those Māori were fighting on the government's side.
The war got even more brutal. In Taranaki, bounties were offered for the severed heads of Pai Marire followers.
Meanwhile, on the east coast, Te Kōti launched a vicious midnight raid on the village of Matawhero near Gisborne. About 60 people, Māori and Pākehā, were bayoneted, clubbed or shot to death, including women and infants. The survivors fled across the Waipawa River to a local British garrison. Lieutenant Frederick Gascoigne described the scene like this.
Men and women were eagerly inquiring of every newcomer for information of their missing friends. Mothers were weeping alone for their children, wives for their husbands, and husbands for their wives.
To Te Kōti, the slaughter was utu for his illegal imprisonment in the Chatham Islands, but it became infamous among settlers as the Poverty Bay Massacre, and those settlers demanded utu of their own.
Just 7 weeks later, Colonel George Whitmore and a combined force of Pākehā and Māori troops launched an assault on Te Kōti's formidable pā at Ngā Tapa. Te Kōti himself escaped, but around 120 of his followers were executed by government-allied Māori, while settler soldiers and even a cabinet minister watched. A member of the armed constabulary called J.P. Ward was one of the witnesses. Here's how he described it.
There was no mention of a trial, or if any or all of them had participated in the Poverty Bay massacre. That did not matter to us one straw. They were shot and their bodies left to swelter and rot under the summer's sun, and their bones to bleach to this day. All of this and very much more, as done beneath the meteor flag of mighty England.
Ultimately, the worst fears of the colonial government never happened. In Taranaki, Tituku Wairu's followers abandoned him. According to one story, he was accused of sleeping with another chief's wife, which violated his authority to lead. Meanwhile, on the east coast, Te Kuti's forces were driven out of their sanctuary in the dense forest of Te Uruwera by a brutal anti-insurgency campaign and forced to take refuge in the King Country. Later in life, Te Kuti became a pacifist and he actually made apologies to the Māori and Pākehā who he'd harmed.
By 1872, the New Zealand Wars were pretty much over. Nearly 3,000 people lost their lives. More than 2,000 of those casualties were Māori, and many of the people killed on both sides were civilians. But death and injury weren't the only consequences. The wars broke the ability of Māori to resist colonisation by force. All through the conflict, the government confiscated land from so-called rebels, 1.5 million hectares in total. That's about 5% of New Zealand's entire land area.
5% might not sound like much, but this was some of the North Island's most valuable land. The fertile farmland of Waikato and Taranaki, the natural deep water harbour at Tauranga. Sometimes the government wanted this land so much, it authorised confiscations from neutral Māori, or even from Māori who'd fought alongside the Crown.
Talking about confiscations in terms of percentages and hectares can sound a bit sterile. I mean, for Māori, this story isn't just about the fact the land was taken, it's also about what happened to that land after it was taken. For example, here's an extract from an article by Māori journalist and editor Leonie Hayden about land confiscation at Ihu Matau, a peninsula near Manukau Harbour.
In 1863, the land was illegally confiscated from Māori. Sacred hills were quarried, 800-year-old burial sites were demolished, archaeological remains were destroyed, a sewage treatment plant was built over traditional fishing grounds, and a dye spill killed the local creek.
When we talk about the government seizing Māori land, we're not just talking about losing farmland or houses. We're talking about the destruction of urupa and the desecration of tapu. It's not just economic damage, it's spiritual and cultural damage.
And these confiscations from the New Zealand Wars weren't the end of the government's efforts to seize Māori land. In fact, most North Island land was transferred into Pākehā ownership after the wars ended. In a future episode, we'll look at how that happened. But first, we'll look at why South Islanders wanted to become a separate country, how a scrap over booze won women the right to vote, and how refrigeration saved our economy from the brink of disaster.
The Aotearoa History Show is a 14-part series made possible by the RNZ New Zealand On Air Digital Innovation Fund. The executive producer is Tim Watkin. It's written and produced by William Ray and co-presented by Lee Marama McLaughlin. The sound engineer is William Saunders and it is directed by Duncan Smith. Historical fact-checking by Basil Keane and the Ministry of Culture and Heritage, especially David Green. Archival audio from Ngā Taonga Sound and Vision. A video version of the Aotearoa History Show is available online via the RNZ webpage or on YouTube.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.